Good morning, afternoon, and evening, everyone. Welcome back to First Let's Talk Title, where the topic is title, and we'll go from there. And good grief, we went there in these episodes. George has brought together the League of Extraordinary Titlemen, which includes Ross Weaver of Town Square Title, Brad Elder of Select Title, and Steve Rainey from Texas Title of El Paso. These men are leaders in the title industry who provide knowledge and experience. And they are dudes who get off topic to discuss Van Halen and Dallas Cowboys any chance they get. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to sit back, relax, and now first, let's talk title.
Started on this. I want to introduce, well, actually introduce yourself, starting down at the end. You.
Brad Elder, Select Title in Houston, Texas.
Steve Rainey, Texas Title Company in El Paso, Texas.
Ross Weaver, Town Square Title, Ellis County, Johns County, Hood County, Parker County, lots of counties.
Lots of counties. We got two more guys showing up later, Bob and Claude. But before that, well, I always believe that when we talk these things, when I start these things, everybody's a story. Every single one of us has a beginning. You know, so what is the story that got you to the point where you are today? Just where you came from, how you got to where you are, things that are important on your path to whatever it is that we're pathing to. And I'll start down there with Brad.
Start with a big one, huh? I'll give you a little bit of background on me. I guess from a title insurance standpoint, while I was in law school, went to law school a little bit later in life. I met a friend of mine who's still a friend in law school, who was working for a title company here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And he had asked me about, what I was going to do after law school. And he said, we should open a fee office. And I said, that sounds fantastic. What in the hell is a fee office? And he said, well, it's you close real estate deals and issue title insurance. I'm like, I have no idea what title insurance even is. And I bought a couple of houses at the time, but I didn't have any. I just thought it was an extension of a bank somewhere. So make a long story short, I made the trek back to Lubbock, built a title plant there from the ground up, which was a monumental task. But did that for about 8 years, sold it in 2016, I guess. And along the way, I thought I'd like to do this in a bigger market. I had the business plan figured out, and I was about to set the world on fire. And for a little bit, I got down to Houston and realized I forgot my matches to set the world on fire. So we're doing the same thing down there. Have been doing it for a few years now. I think what kind of led me into this arena was someone told me that you can't do it all. Just surround yourself with great people who know how to do the things that you don't know how to do. And that's what I've tried to do, because I really can't do anything inside of a title company, to be honest with you. I'm kidding. That's the key for me, and I think everybody can agree to that. If you don't have the right people in the right places, then you're dead in the water for the most part. So that's kind of what I've built it on. Built my company on is surrounding myself with the absolute best people and then treating them the way they want to be treated.
Steve?
Yes, I'm originally from the Lubbock area. I went to school in Austin at the University of Texas. I have a bachelor's degree in business, I have a law degree and an MBA from Texas. And when I was in law school, I interviewed with a law firm from Amarillo. They didn't offer me a job, but they did offer me some advice. They told me to take a look at the title business. And so I went and interviewed with a title company in Amarillo, and I really liked what I heard, liked what she talked about. She didn't offer me a job either, so I kept looking for a job in the title business, and I finally wound up in El Paso, Texas in 1992. Started off as a title examiner, making $18,000 a year, plus a bonus. We were on a bonus system, so. And I was there for 2 years. I became the title plant manager. I really enjoyed that. Did that for 3 years. Then I spent 5 years working for a law firm. And then I went back into the title business and worked for the largest title company in El Paso. And I was the title plan manager, and I was an attorney. I had a real estate law practice on the side. And I did that for about 5 years. And then I kind of got kicked out of the title company. I was asked to make a choice. And so I chose to keep my law practice and start my own title company. So I opened up in December 2008 at the beginning of the real estate recession. And fortunately, we've been open for 10 years. We've grown, we've prospered, and thanks to a lot of great people at Texas Title, we've been successful.
Ross?
So my journey's different, at least. I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a law degree. And I have most of a college degree. I do have a diploma from Midlothian High School, though, and I'm pretty proud of that. I grew up in a real estate family. My dad's a real estate developer. My grandfather owned a local community bank in Midlothian during my formative years. And so that's where I got my exposure to kind of how the process works. I went and thought I was going to be a software developer. I actually went to school for that. Dropped out because I got a job as a software developer, and then the late 90 software developer industry kind of evaporated for anybody that didn't have a degree or 10 years of experience, and I got to go back into real estate. Worked with the family-owned real estate development company from 2002 to about 2008 when the real estate industry then evaporated, and had the opportunity to go work for one of our local community banks, Citizens National Bank of Texas. They brought me in to help do credit analysis and distress asset underwriting during the economic recession of 09 to 11, 12, depending on which metric you use to measure that. In 2011, they gave me the opportunity to come over to Town Square Title, which was a merger or a joint operation between them and a local attorney, John Ray, who's our state representative for House District 10. And basically walked in and they said, figure it out. And that's what I've been doing ever since then, and had the opportunity to now grow from one office location to seven offices, from about eight employees when I joined the title company to over 50 at this point. And it's been a great journey, and a lot of bumps and bruises and learning along the way. The key is surrounding yourself with people that are smarter than you, that really know how to take care of the business. We've got a phenomenal title plant team in-house, a phenomenal post-closing team, order entry team, closing teams that work together to seamlessly support our customers and treat people the way they want to be treated. I think Brad said it best. I mean, that's the key to success, is if we're giving them the level of service that we would expect, then everything kind of takes care of itself along the way.
All of you, without any prompting, had the same common theme, and that each of you talked about the people that work, however you want to put it, for you, with you, part of you. That's a hell of a responsibility, which, you know, that's the only thing about this business. Sometimes, yeah, I can deal with pretty anything, except when I think it might impact somebody that looks, we wake up every day, and believe it or not, people look at us as to being leaders with the answers. If something bad happens, we're supposed to fix it and already have the answer. And what you're going to find out throughout this deal is we're all a bunch of dumbasses.
For the most part,
mm-hmm. There's a high level of dumbassery in this group, but it's also a high level of intelligence, production, talent, and gumption. Which it. But I don't know about you, but does that weigh on you more than other things? As far as how it relates to, I mean, we have now 35 people that work for us. And if you add children and things like that, we're bumping over 200 mouths that kind of look to FNTI as being the source of what makes them happy and responsible. And how do you guys deal with that? Do you deal with that? Do you think about it?
I've thought a lot about it, in that we have, I think, 50 between, depending on the, I guess, time, around 55 employees. And I think, you know, I'm responsible for 55 mortgages being paid, probably 110 or more car payments being paid, sending a bunch of kids to college. That's a tremendous weight on, I know these two other gentlemen sitting here, on my shoulders as well as him, I'm sure. It's, and if you ever have to, in the unfortunate situation you ever have to let someone go for whatever reason, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm telling this person that you're not going to you're going to have trouble coming up with money to pay your mortgage next month or your car payment. That weighs on me a tremendous amount. So, yes, to say I think about it is an absolute.
Yeah, it makes it hard to sleep at night sometimes because I have one primary responsibility, and that's to make payroll twice a month. The money has to be there to make those paychecks clear when the employees take those home. So you take those 40 families, you're talking about families, single moms who have to take care of the kids, and you know, worry about their bonuses. You know, is there enough money to pay them the kind of bonuses where they can pay for the stuff that they need to? You know, I worry about making sure that they make enough money so that they can be prosperous and be happy and pay all the different things that they need to pay for. So I worry about them having a great work environment where they can go out and get more business, where they can do a better job so that they and everybody that works with them can make more money. I worry about that every day.
A short time. I've known you for a while now, and I've seen your responsibilities grow. I've seen the people who look towards you for bigger things and before grow. And how, so you're sort of, you're on that path. You've done it quicker than most, I'll tell you that. And you're one of those people that I can point to and say, here's a guy who went from one area to another area and has been successful. That's one thing about title insurance is there are no excuses. I do believe you have an inherent talent, an inherent drive. You can be successful in this business no matter what. So are you prepared for that? Or is that something you've thought about till now? We're going to bum the crap out of you? Or, you know, I mean, as you get moving, your responsibility is going to be greater, but it's not just to your employers. It's going to be to the people who are going to look to you as a leader.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the key component is the buck has to stop somewhere. And I refer to it a lot of times as what I call the inverted pyramid, because people think it rolls downhill, but it often comes right back up. And somebody's got to deal with that at that point.
Steve, did they have the inverted pyramid when you were getting your MBA?
No, that was not in any of my classwork. No.
That's a practical application. That's not a theoretical application. So
that's in the lab, man.
Exactly. So it is a challenge to, especially, you know, leading people that have been in the industry longer than you have or have more direct experience in any position that they're sitting in than you have. So we run the gambit. I've got 20-year-olds who don't know come here from Sikkim, and then I've got folks that are at the power position of their career with the wisdom gained through a great career in title. And so being able to balance those things and to learn from those who've gone before, but still be able to, at the end of the day, say, no, it's time to make a decision and that responsibility falls on me, it's huge. And like they said, we've got to make sure that our teams are paid, that our teams have the tools, training, and technology they need to be successful. And that's ultimately when I define my job, is my responsibility is to make sure my team has the tools, training, and technology to be successful in their jobs.
You brought up a good point, as you all have, but I think it'd be fair to say that all of us have people who work for us who have more experience than us.
No question.
Who may have had a longer path, and for lack of a better term, we're in position of leadership. And that's a tricky thing to do. And I'll give you an example. He's passed away, Mark Basile, but he was at First American. And he said something that I'll just impart to you. And we had a situation where First American, in essence, took over an agent. They bought an agent. They were operating as a separate entity. And then they decided, as big underwriters do, to roll them in. And Mark was going to be in charge. And this was about 30 people who, the things that you just said, you could tell on their faces, like, holy crap, I'm not going to have a paycheck. Oh my God, they're going to replace me with somebody else. And he walked in and he could have been, but he said, you don't owe me a single thing. You don't owe me your loyalty. You don't owe me your respect. I owe that to you. And the day that I don't do that, we won't be successful, but you have zero to worry about. I am the one who has to earn your respect. I'm the one who has to earn your loyalty. I'm the one who has to give you a sense of, and he said, peace of mind, that I know what I'm doing and what I'm doing is for best for all of us. And if it's something you don't like, I owe you an explanation as to why. That's something that I've gotten better at, but explaining the whys. That's hard. I mean, I think sometimes when you make a decision, it's easier just to do it than to articulate to somebody the thought process to do it.
Yeah, you're bringing up some good points here. You know, I think, I can't remember which leader said it, maybe it was Richard Branson, and I've kind of tried to take that as a motto of mine, is I don't see my customer as the agent who brings us business or the buyer or the seller. My customer is each and every employee of Select Title. I am completely beholden to them. If I give them a great working environment, I empower them to do the things that they need to do, and I'm keep them engaged, not just happy, because you can have a happy employee who may be fantastically overpaid and doing nothing. They're probably pretty happy, but it's way more difficult to keep an engaged employee, and in turn, then they're going to be able to affect the end user or end customer at that point, because we can't touch every single customer that's out there. We just absolutely can't. So my customer is the people that are on my payroll. That's the way I look at it.
Well, this isn't the early 1900s anymore. You can't rule your company with an iron fist. That just doesn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, people, you know, the employees who work for me, the escrow officers, escrow assistants, they have other opportunities. I have other title companies in El Paso constantly approaching my people to come work for them. So my responsibility as the president and owner of the company is to keep those escrow officers and escrow assistants happy, because they have alternatives. They have options. So it's, you know, that's just part of what we have to do. We have to keep them happy. We have to take care of them. We have to give them lots of good reasons to stay working for our title company.
I would say that, but as men, or dudes, or whatever, we do a horrible job letting people know how we feel.
Until we're mad, I guess.
Yeah. And then I've had to learn that you can't read mind. Other people are not mind readers. And as leaders, and all of you have kind of two of you, Brad and Steve, I've been with you from the beginning and had various influences, bad, good, or indifferent. And Ross in Town Square, I've seen grow in the 4 or 5 years I've been with them. And yet none of you guys are little companies anymore. You guys are looked upon as true competitors. You guys do have sizable payrolls, business. And that's scary at one point, but also exciting. And I think Steve hit it right on the head that, you know, those are the things that I think, at least I do, I have to do a better job, because sometimes I don't articulate. Not that I have to articulate every feeling, but sometimes we don't do a good job with that.
I think you have to be intentional with your praise. It's very easy to be accidental with your criticism. It's a natural part of what we do, in that when mistakes happen, when we have opportunities, as I like to call them, opportunities for growth, because mistakes are only mistakes if we don't fix them or learn from them, in my opinion. Everything else is an opportunity for growth, and we really push that mantra throughout our company, but is finding the time to stop at the front desk and tell the person there, you know what, I appreciate the fact that you set the tone for everybody that walks in the door of our office. Because if you have a smile on your face and a song in your heart when they come in, it may change their entire outlook. They may have come in with a thundercloud and leave with a rainbow. And that's huge. You mentioned the whys, and I want to touch back on that. Please. Too, because I think it is important that we do articulate why. But one thing I learned, or have been learning still, I don't always do great with it, is not everybody cares about the why every time. And some people care about it sometimes, but not others. So it's hard as a leader that I find myself sometimes oversharing when they're like, would you just shut up and let me get back to what I have to do? Or they're going, wait, no, I really don't understand. And I want to know why we're turning and going a different direction or retooling this. So it's being listening, I guess, is probably the biggest challenge that I've had as we've continued to grow, is truly listening to what's coming towards us, instead of just telling the masses, here's what we're going to do.
They say the most powerful trait one can have, particularly a man, is to listen. To listen, not talk. And I don't do a very good job. I do. It's a hit and miss thing. Okay, we're going to do a little off topic, then back on topic. We were talking about Motley Crue. In fact, when I first met Steve, he picked me up in his burnt orange Corvette, and all I could hear driving down is boom, 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 shout, shout. And I'm like, who in the hell is that? And it was Steve.
That's your newest agent.
Well, funny thing about that is we can say it now. He was the first agent I ever had. And in North America, not to brag, he was the first independent agent I think they had. It shows you how we've grown. I'll share the story that possibly we didn't follow all the steps to get things done before he started closing deals. But that was, again, where I want to get details. We are not detail-oriented. Men, in general, may not be the most detailed-oriented. We're going to get to that in a second, but I want to talk about something even more important than Motley Crue, the mighty Van Halen. And I just look at all three of your smiles on your face. So are you a Sammy or a Dave guy?
And Sammy.
You're a Sammy.
I'll have to say David Lee Roth, because my favorite two songs are sung by him.
Which are?
Running with the Devil and The Cradle Will Rock.
Is it frightening how this younger generation swings? It's more than just new sensation. The kid is losing half the sleep. He goes home, blah, blah, more than just blah, blah, that one.
Yes.
That's about how he sang it when I saw him, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He was halfway in it, and he made up a new song, which sounded like The Cradle Will Rock. You?
I'm way too young for this question. Thank you.
Stop it.
Okay, you're an So why I ask that is a couple of things. You know, that's like a defining thing when you talk to guys. Are they Sammy or Dave? You'll never find somebody that's both. Here's the trick that I found. It's even with that in our business, is that we have preconceived notions of what is right or wrong, no matter what. And there are people that no matter what will say, I am a David Lee Roth guy. When Sammy Hagar took over Van Halen, it was the end of civilization. What they don't realize is, who do you think sold more albums? It's close, but they say Sammy, who had the more hits. Sammy. But, and who was the better singer? You can make an argument, but I would never say David Lee Roth was a true crooner.
Not at all.
But sometimes in life and everything, some people just have a visceral love for something that's based on things that make no sense. But I'm going to tell you who my favorite singer is. Gary Cherone. Do you remember Gary Cherone?
He was the next lead singer.
He was the third lead singer with Van Halen. Now, here's what I admire about him. They've asked him, because he lasted one album, one tour, the lowest selling tour ever, the lowest selling album ever. They've asked him, do you think it was a failure? What do you think he said?
I would hope he would say no and have a good reason.
His reason was, he goes, first of all, those royalty checks for a shitty Van Halen album is still a pretty good royalty. Two, he woke up every day knowing, he knew that his job was totally beholden to two guys not feeling like they wanted to come back. So if you think about it, for a year and a half, every day he woke up thinking he was going to get a call saying, Sammy's back in, Dave's back in. But here's the thing that I think sometimes we have to embrace the moment. He goes, do you realize how many singers on this planet would die to be the lead singer of Van Halen? He goes, for a year and a half, I toured with Eddie on my left, Michael on my right, and I sang all the songs. And he goes, the easy route would have been to say no. Right? Have you ever had something that you're like, oh crap, I said no and wish I hadn't? Business-wise, you don't want to, you know. But is there something like you wish you had gone for something and didn't do it?
Certainly, I think we could probably all come up with multiple examples of both. I think there have been some moves I've made, especially early on, that I wish I hadn't. Mainly when it comes to expanding. Everybody who's ever hired an escrow officer, and every single escrow officer I've ever interviewed, all does between $80,000 and $100,000 a month in revenue, and they can bring all that business with them.
Guaranteed.
Guaranteed. That hasn't worked out exactly like that. So there have been several I would have wish I had a mulligan on. As far as things I wish I would have done but didn't, I think I have a decent ability to chalk it up as the past and not, that ship has sailed, can't do anything about it now, and go. So I don't dwell on those. It's easy to dwell on the mistakes because sometimes you're still paying for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's easy to do. But, and not to be too heady here and make you too, you absolutely have to learn from them though. I've learned so much going through this process. When I built Title One, I'm not gonna say it came easy because it didn't. Man, things fell into place pretty well. And then you go and try to do it again, thinking I've got all the answers, and you don't have all the answers. So the learning that you get from the, I screwed that one up, you have to learn from it, or else you're just gonna keep doing it, and guess what, you're not gonna be in the business very long, so.
Well, I think the hardest part of our job is firing people. And so you have some people who have been with you for years and you know you need to let them go, but it's hard to let them go because you know it's going to wreck their lives financially, personally. And so there are times when I've kept employees for too long when I should have let them go sooner. So, yeah, that's something that I certainly struggle with, and I think probably most owners struggle with.
I mean, I think people, at the end of the day, they fire themselves. You know, you may be the one who actually sits down and signs the paperwork with them, but they made that choice most of the time through their actions or lack of actions. And is there some where you feel like, hey, that may have gone on too long? You bet. Is there some that maybe didn't go long enough? That's possible, too. But I'm with Brad. I mean, it's hard to have true regrets. I mean, I feel like the opportunities that I saw and presented themselves, I've seized throughout my career and bounced around from several different industries to land where I'm at. I mean, I did not go to the 7th grade career day fair and say, I want to be in title insurance.
You weren't there?
No, I wasn't. It wasn't even an option from what I remember on the checklist that was there. You know, they had firefighter and soldier.
How cool would it be to be a firefighter, though?
Right.
I mean, if you could do any job that had nothing, you could do any job and money wasn't an object, what would you do?
I'd be the quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. I mean, it's easy.
So you would lose a lot of games, be yelled at by everybody.
And win more Super Bowls than whatever team you're a fan of.
28 years ago. Okay, let's bring it up. I assume you're all Cowboy fans?
I think Brad just said if Quincy Carter can do it, anybody can do it. I think that's what I heard him say. I'm not positive.
Why in God's name are the Cowboys still the number one? And I'll say they are the number one football team as far as recognition, popularity. Why do they have a network that's second to none, but yet it's been 20, and I'm just bringing 26 years?
Whenever Super Bowl 20, 1993.
Okay. Why are they still the end-all, be-all when by most measures, that's not the case? And I think we have competitors like that. We have competitors out there that in all your markets that say, oh, my God, would we have to close at, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll say, well, why? They have slower turn time. Their escrow officers are less professional. And yet people are built in some market. I think all of you have that. How do you overcome that? And by the way, if you want to be the quarterback for the Cowboys, that's fine.
I was born with a severe lack of talent, though, and size and arm strength and speed and intellect. So other than that, though, I was right there.
Besides genetics and talent, you were there. No, Steve, what would you do?
I like the quarterback job. That sounds like fun.
Do you realize that answer is not – well, I'll wait till what you say, and then I'm going to tell you why I'm not shocked at this answer.
Any job, regardless of salary, still able to live. That's a tough one. I mean, that's one of the fantastic things.
That's why you're in here, man.
Think about. I moonlight as a martial arts instructor at my son's karate school, and I would probably, if I could make a really good living doing that, I could be swayed that direction. You get to mold minds and help kids learn core values and self defense, and it's a lot of fun.
I want to be a lead singer of the biggest rock band in the world. I think that would be the most badass thing ever.
Rock star athlete. That's what most guys want to do.
That's what it is. But you guys all... And okay, so what's the best martial arts for a woman to learn to defend themselves?
Any.
Why?
But at the end of the day, it's about preparation and mindset more than it is about physical moves. I mean, every different discipline out there has different skill sets and things they'll teach you, but ultimately, at the end of the day, it's about have you conditioned yourself to perceive a threat and to react to a threat without being frozen up by a threat.
9mm is way quicker, though.
Absolutely. But again, that's you got to practice it. You go to the range. You got to go through scenarios.
Ross, you'd say there's some places where one shouldn't bring a gun?
There is definitely places where legally one should not bring a gun.
Okay, well, that's for a different podcast. All right, so argue with me this if you can. Steven Seagal is the baddest ass in the history of martial arts on, not Bruce Lee, I get it, but Steven Seagal could kick some serious ass. Would we all agree to that?
He could make short work of me. Extremely short work, yes.
Brad, it's amazing how everything has gone back to how they would beat you up. It wasn't the question if you would get your ass kicked.
I thought this is not the Brad podcast? No. I thought these were my guests.
All right, if you what? Were... Okay, there's a bar, and there's always a bar in every cool movie where there's these guys, right? Who would you like to see kick their ass the most? Now, this is a snapshot into a men's... I say Steven Seagal, because he
Are we talking about who's going to kick Brad's ass?
Okay, Brad's at a bar and he's...
Pee-wee Herman could kick my ass.
Steve, who's your baddest ass kicker in the TV?
You know, I'm going to go old school and go with Chuck Norris.
Amen, oh, brother.
Oh, jeez.
Amen. That was mine, too.
I'd like
not as Walker.
No, not as that Ranger guy.
No. You mean like pre-Walker, like Delta Team 6 when he...
We're talking
like
Vietnam
1 through 35.
Era. Ooh, Chuck Norris.
He may be the toughest man in the history of the world.
Well, he is. Do you know when he files his taxes, he just files a picture of his foot, and he's never been audited? I gotta laugh at Steve.
Oh, boy. Boys, boys, boys. Well, my kick-ass choice will be brought up in the next episode, but if you want to join the Badass Action Star conversation, feel free to mention your favorite ass-kicker in the comments section of the Podbean channel. Also, make sure to follow us so you don't miss our latest episodes. Now, the League of Extraordinary Titlemen will return in our two upcoming podcasts. They will be talking about their likes, dislikes about underwriters, and then they go down the rabbit hole once again. I promise you don't want to miss it. So hope to have you back with us at First, Let's Talk Title.